welcome to the Mormon News Report podcast for the week of August 21st, 2017. We are your weekly dose of Mormonism.
With a helping of big boy snark today, so get your big boy and big girl pants on because, Brian, I am feeling spicy today.
Ooh, spicy. Hey, we've got a great show lined up for you. Rachel Hunt Steenblick, author of Mother's Milk, Poems in Search of Heavenly Mother, will be joining us.
You know, it's a wonderful book, and I'm not even really a poetry guy, but it really hit me in the feels, so I really recommend it to people. But before we begin, as always, just a plug regarding the Mormon News Report extended sessions that are available to Patreon.com subscribers. For just $1 a month, you'll receive access to our conversations with guests we have when the recording light goes off.
It's like being able to scope out the cool kids table and wonder, hey, what are they talking about? Well, how come I wasn't invited? You wouldn't know anything about that, though, would you, Brant?
Middle school was rough. High school was rough. College was rough. Brian, there's a reason why I do all my stuff on the internet now. Plus, your $1 a month will help support our efforts to provide you with the best coverage, commentary, analysis, and a sprinkling of snark to breaking Mormon news. Guys, it's simple. Just head over to patreon.com/Mormon News Report and become a Patreon subscriber today. For example, if you sign up in the future, we're going to have a great conversation with Max Perry Mueller where he gets into everything regarding race, Mormonism, J. Manning James, and it was great, but you can't hear it unless you're part of the Patreon group. In other news, Brian, I hear you went to the Love Loud concert festival last night.
I'm sorry, Brant, what? What was that? I'm having trouble hearing you with this ringing in my ears.
I said, I hear you went to... Wait a minute. I see what you did there.
You know what, Brant? I did go. I went with my entire family, and they really put the loud in love. Let's just put it that way. But it was a truly amazing experience. I mean, besides being able to watch Imagine Dragons and Neon Trees...
I will say, by the way, my wife was extremely jealous, and that's all I've heard about for the past few days is, well, Brian and his family went to go see Imagine Dragons and Neon Trees. What about us?
Well, it was a bit of a trek for you. But besides them, there were four or five other acts, and they put a ton of speeches and shorter performances. People like Carolyn Pearson were there speaking. Social media sensation 12-year-old Savannah was there. And Tom Christofferson, who I love it, introduced himself as the, quote, not the famous brother, but the gay brother.
You know what? That is so Tom Christofferson too. Well, you know what, Brian? I'm glad because it sounds like it was a tremendous event. I heard there was a ton of people there.
Yeah, 17,000 people packed this football field at Utah Valley University, and it was a tremendous success. A majority of the money went to go fund local charities that work with LGBTQ youth, and particularly in working with like suicide prevention and whatnot. It was a very touching concert. And apparently, and here's the big news, the good news for your wife, they're going to be doing this every year.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So this is the first time I'd ever seen Imagine Dragons or Neon Trees. And, you know, they both blew me away. And I've seen Tyler Glenn perform solo acoustic before, but seeing him in his element with his band, his full band, just really showed what an amazing performer he is. That guy was like Mick Jagger up on the stage. And the entire event was emceed by none other than Alex Boyer.
Alex Boyer. Let's talk about this guy. I swear, I think he does pretty much everything out there in Utah.
Yeah, this guy. Indeed he does. In fact, I think you can see him next week as he emcees the new supermarket opening in Springville.
You serious about that, Brian?
No.
Darn.
So listen, we've had a few weeks of heavy news, so what do you say we go a little bit lighter this week?
Finally. So what do you got for me, Brian? Do we got some clickbaity Mormon blogs about how this Facebook user's response is epic in shutting down a hater? No, wait. How about a corny Mormon meme shared by my grandmother that is just hilarious? You know what? I got it. The one blog post by that one guy that will answer any hard question you ever had about the LDS church in 140 characters or less. Is that where we're going this week?
Well, I've got a video here from LDS Living titled "A Lesbian Couple Shares Why They Divorced to Join the Church" in powerful video.
Oh, this should be good. All right. So, okay. What do you got?
So before we get into this story, let's state up front what LDS Living posted in an editorial note. This is what they said. This is a personal story of how two women came to join the church. It's important to remember that every person's journey is different, and we acknowledge that gay members of the church should find the solution that best works for their situation. This story was shared as a part of a series called Splitting the Sky.
So Splitting the Sky is an online documentary series featuring stories of predominantly LDS women. Their site states, "We seek to find and share authentic stories of faithful women, and by doing so, open our connection to God, ourselves, and each other."
So let's go to work here. But first, this is a touching video. It really pulls at the Mormon heartstrings, and it tells a very emotional journey of both Courtney and Rochelle.
And additionally, the entire Splitting the Sky series is a very good documentary series. It's on YouTube, but it really does look professional. It's done by three women, and the production quality and stories are very, very good. So here's a clip just to give you a sampling of what it sounds like.
We don't know what our lives will look like in 20 years. We don't. But we have the faith that our Heavenly Father's plan for us is better than our own. The ideas that we had for our life were so great. And we gave those up. Because we know that our Heavenly Father's plan is better.
So before we discuss this particular story further, I think that we should note a statement that the creators of this video posted on their Facebook page. It reads, "We are grateful that the video sharing a glimpse of Courtney and Rochelle's journey is reaching so many. We regret that most media headlines sensationalize the story and detract from our intended focus. We want to clarify that our intention is to share stories of women opening to God. We believe that this process of opening is different and personal for everyone. Courtney and Rochelle's story is about love and having a relationship with Christ. Your experience may be similar, but your answer may be different. And we sacredly honor that. We encourage you to honor your own story and reach out to others in an effort to honor theirs."
I really, really love that because I think that encapsulates a lot of what's going on. So, Brian, I don't want to call us, I don't want to call us Mormon media watchdogs.
But
we're kind of Mormon media watchdogs of all stripes. And the creators, Kamalyn, Anna, and Amber, are 100% right. I don't think they intended this story to be weaponized or sensationalized at all. I am very glad they did it because the story was great. But I would really hope that they were also aware of how everyone was going to be spinning this.
But Brant, it also leads to a much bigger issue that should be discussed more, and that's the experience of the gay believing Mormon. I mean, this story had a happy ending because they followed the script, and that's not a bad thing. I love the stories that Splitting the Sky is focusing on, the journey of people opening to God.
But in essence, the story of the gay believing Mormon is one that isn't talked about a lot because they usually don't have a happily ever after story like Courtney and Rochelle.
So John Gustav Rathall, who is a member of the Affirmation, he's on the board of Affirmation, and himself a gay, married, ex-Mormon who is still active in the church, commented on this story saying, "Gay couples have one extra challenge, and that is that they are constantly bombarded with messages that there's no future for them, that their relationships are inherently unstable, and that they're sinful. Sometimes we're cast out of our families and our churches for committing to one another, which makes those messages cut even deeper."
This is a great story. Don't anyone misinterpret me there. This is a great story. It's an inspiring story. You know what, Brian? This was even a story that warmed the cold and dead cockles of my heart. But let's let the story be the story. Don't share it in the hopes that the gay Mormons who left the church will come back in droves, because this is the one thing that they're missing.
And that's my biggest concern with this whole story. Don't make Courtney and Rochelle pawns in whatever fight for or against Mormonism that you're currently engaged in. We've seen this happen before, Brant, and we've even seen this happen by LDS Living articles. For instance,
oh, interesting.
Yeah, for instance, when they interviewed Josh Weed, who's a gay Mormon who's happily married to a woman. That story got shared by Mormons everywhere. Even my own family members shared that story saying, "See? All you have to do is marry straight and just pray away the gay." Mm-hmm. Josh himself was like, "No, wait, hold on. This may have worked for me, but this isn't a prescription that I'm trying to apply on Mormons everywhere." And I feel like the same thing is happening with this Courtney and Rochelle story. No matter how much LDS Living tries to preface this, or the creators of this video try to preface this as kind of a, you know, results may vary, Mormons are still going to use this as some sort of model. But to be fair, the fact that LDS Living keeps promoting stories like this as inspiring is, yeah, well, it's kind of a whole different discussion that's probably worth having. So, okay, what's next?
So Brian, have you ever been to BYU's Education Week?
I thought that was just for seminary teachers.
Don't know if you know this, but anyone can attend. And it actually took place this last week. So I looked at the speaker schedule, and it looks like there was some really good stuff there. For example, Michael McKay had some interesting sessions focusing on the Seer Stones and the Book of Mormon translation process. I think that kind of fits into the stuff that you and I are interested in, legitimate scholarly historical work. There was also Brian W. Rick's interesting series on the life of James E. Talmadge, where he gets into things like James E. Talmadge getting an education, James E. Talmadge service within the church, et cetera, et cetera. Looks like meaty historical stuff. And let's not forget our old pal Garrett Dirkmat and his lectures on building the kingdom, Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and the Council of 50. So there was some good stuff there.
Yeah, but then there's also those other sessions, you know, like Ted H. Ong's series of lectures titled Investing for Growth While Managing Risk, Beating Inflation Using Nobel Prize Winning Yet Simple Principles Used by Institutional Investors. Ugh. Or Rick D. Hawk's Strategy for Wars in the Last Days, Successfully Combating Satan.
Ah, yes. And let's also not forget Mary Jane Woodger's Prophet's Love Stories, Courtship Patterns of the Prophet, or Brett H. Latimer's America's Culture Wars, A Tale of Two Americas. Because if there's one thing we need, Brian, it's modeling courtship patterns after LDS leaders and more cultural infighting. And before you all get mad at me, I say that with tongue firmly planted in cheek, because I didn't go to any of those. So those sessions might surprise me, or it might be what we thought all along.
Yeah, I don't know. Every time that I hear something about the prophet and courtship and love stories, I get a little bit leery. Yeah. But Brant, there was another conference also that we should be talking about. This was the Book of Mormon Chiasmus Conference on August 16th, where your friend and mine, Elder Jeffrey O'Holland, made an appearance.
So can you explain chiasmus to me? I'm not sure I understand it. It's very foreign. I get very confused, and I'm hoping you can shed some light.
You know what, Brant? This is a great time to introduce our guest, Jared Riddick. Jared, welcome to the show. Can you help with Brant's question? I mean, chiasm, it kind of sounds like a condition that you go see a doctor for.
Doc, I woke up with this thing and I'm worried it might be a chiasm.
We'll see what we can do to help. Chiasmus is a writing style where you take keywords, concepts, and ideas building up until you reach a central point that you want to focus on, and then give those ideas, concepts, and keywords in reverse order.
Wait, did you just do that chiastically?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Hey, I see what you did there. So let me ask, is chiasmus ancient?
Yes. Originally, it was just thought to be a Hebraic style. But when Jack discovered it in the 1960s, it was thought to be that way. But it's now been found all over the ancient Near East and even Mesoamerica.
So before we move on, who is Jack? I don't think our listeners are too familiar with him.
John W. Welsh, also known as Jack, as a professor at the J. Reuben Clark Law School at BYU, who also specialized in ancient Near Eastern studies in his undergrad, except for did his master's degree on chiasmus.
I know that his story's been told a lot, but what's the quick and dirty summary of how he discovered chiasmus?
On a P-Day, or it's actually a D-Day, when he served his mission, Jack and his companion went to a lecture in his area in Regensburg, Germany, where he was introduced to the idea of literary style in the New Testament. So he bought a book the lecturer mentioned. He studied it over the course of a week, and then early one morning awoke to the idea that if it was evidence, chiasmus, of Hebrew literary style in the Bible, then it'll be evidence of it in the Book of Mormon. The miracle, which I've heard him say, was that he even got up that morning.
Which, let me just acknowledge right here and right now, my P-Day was, hey, let's go play some basketball and write some emails. Yet Jack Welch is going to listen to lectures on the New Testament. So let's just put that into context for the type of person that Jack is. So then, Jared, let me ask you, what was the first chiasm that he found?
It was Mosiah 5:10-12. And if any of the listeners today actually would like to hear the full story, I would definitely recommend going to the BMC Studios YouTube channel. It's one of the channels from Book of Mormon Central, and watching their video, The Discovery of Chiasmus in the Book of Mormon.
So we're going to make sure we link to this website in the show notes, so you all be able to find it there. Let's get something a little awkward out of the way first. People seem to find chiasms everywhere these days. So they find it in the Family Proclamation. They find it in Facebook posts. Let me get this straight. Even in Green Eggs and Ham?
Chiasmania is a real problem. It's one of the reasons we can't have nice things.
Chiasmania. See, now it's like we're really talking about medical conditions. So how do you identify a chiasm, and how do you know that it's not accidental?
There's actually a lot of conversation going on between scholars about this. No one completely agrees, but there is a general consensus around six different points. One, Chiasm should conform to natural literary boundaries, meaning they shouldn't pick up mid-sentence and then pick up mid-paragraph somewhere else. The turning point should really be at the center of the chiasm. The thing it focuses on should really be at the center. These inverted patterns should really be well-balanced and symmetrical. It should not be lopsided. And then their structure should be based off of major keywords, major ideas, major concepts. Shouldn't just be based on an and or an of or something nonsensical like that. There shouldn't be that much riffraff.
Hold on. Riffraff?
There shouldn't be a ton of additional info that doesn't fit into the pattern. Then six, the chiastic order shouldn't typically compete with other patterns in the same passage. So there shouldn't be a chiasm going on in competition with something else, like a limerick or what have you.
So is this pretty foolproof then?
No, nothing's completely foolproof, but this is a fairly solid way to separate the wheat from the chaff. I know, for instance, that Jack himself actually has 15 different criteria that he uses.
Thanks, Jared. I think that helps shed a lot of light on this topic. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Jared Riddick from the Book of Mormon Central. So, okay, Brian, what did Elder Holland
say? Well, at the conference, Elder Holland said, "In making our case for the restored gospel of Jesus Christ, I believe God intends us to find and use the evidence that he has given, reasons, if you will, which affirm the truthfulness of his work. Our testimonies aren't dependent on evidence. We still need that spiritual confirmation in the heart of which we have spoken, but not to seek for and not to acknowledge intellectual, documentable support for our belief when it is available is to needlessly limit an otherwise incomparably strong theological position and deny us a unique, persuasive vocabulary in the latter-day arena of religious investigation and sectarian debate." Brant, when I read this quote, I was like, wow, is Neil A. Maxwell still alive? Because this is the kind of stuff that I would have expected to hear from Elder Maxwell.
So let me guess, complex sentences, multiple starting off points, multisyllabic words, and something that makes you go, hold on a second. Can you repeat that like three or four times?
Yeah, it's something I'm going to have to chew for a while, like a tough steak.
Right. And so here's what I liked about what Elder Holland said. On the one hand, he is acknowledging that we can use some legitimate, rigorous, scholarly ways to looking at our scriptures. At the same time, it seems like he's also making the case that, guys, just because there's chiasmus in there doesn't mean we could base everything on. It's exactly what we talked about with Jared, you know, the whole green eggs and ham and stuff like that. And I'll also say this. I'm glad that Jared brought up chiasmania, because we all know that the only mania that we should be focused on is WrestleMania. And Vince McMahon does not take kindly to appropriating his branded terms.
No.
You better watch out for that. In other news this week, Wallet Hub measured all 50 U.S. states in three categories regarding women's equality: equal treatment in the workplace environment, education and health, and political empowerment. So, Brian, tell me, I've got to imagine Utah had a great showing in this study, right?
Let's just say that Utah seems to hit the top of the list in some areas, and this is not one of them. Mm-hmm. So on the aggregate, Utah was actually, well, dead last on their list, ranking for education and health and political empowerment. And it was 43rd for workplace environment.
Okay. So let's play everyone's favorite game, Brian, the context behind the stats. So don't get me wrong. It's not that the stats are bad.
Well, and it's not that Utah doesn't have work that can be done.
Right. But there are a few things that might provide a deeper story. And of course, there's Mormon angles everywhere. So let's look at some of these stats, okay?
Okay. So first, Utah has the third largest income gap between men and women, surpassed only by North Dakota and Wyoming.
And I don't think this should be surprising at all. For a long time, Mormonism emphasized the traditional narrative of men working and women staying at home with children.
I'm not sure if you've seen it, but it seems like that narrative is being de-emphasized, and the rising generation isn't exactly following that trajectory.
I know when Ashley was working, her cohorts at the church didn't think twice about it. This was something that was just natural, and it wasn't the way it was, I would say, even 20 or 30 years ago when it was like, oh my goodness, you work. I am so sorry. You must be in a horrible situation where you have to work. She didn't experience that at all. So I think that's changing. I also think that this coincides with the largest executive positions gap, where Utah ranked 46 on the list.
So basically what we're seeing here is that there's a high employment rate among women in Utah, but that the majority of it is either part-time work or it's minimum wage, which means that while women are somewhat encouraged to work outside of the home, the tension still exists for women to perform motherly duties. High demand careers, while, you know, women are performing in them, are not the norm in Utah, statistically speaking.
Obviously, there is a big Mormon connection with this, as many Mormon women don't work outside the home. But more and more, studies are beginning to find that women and diversity in workplaces, specifically those in decision-making roles, people leaders and executives, show that businesses actually perform better with the diversity of opinion. I know that for my day job, that's something we talk about consistently. And really, within Mormonism, and I would say even more specifically the BYU colleges, we love to talk about how it's our people that go out and, quote, change the world. But we really should probably amend that. It's our men that go out and change the world in the workplace. And I'm hoping that the rising generations of women will change that trend, because as of right now, I don't think that that's the impression at all. And it's sad because there are so many talented, intelligent Mormon women who are making their way through a lot of these colleges and universities who aren't being able to take advantage of that because of 19th century stereotypes. The other major news this week came out of Salt Lake as the LDS Church announced that divorced men and single men age 31 and older may now serve as temple ordinance workers. Previously, single men could serve through the age of 30, while women were already eligible to serve beyond the age of 31.
Well, let's make something clear. Previous to this point, individuals in those situations could still volunteer for shifts working in the temple, but they couldn't officiate in any ordinances.
For example, I've heard about people volunteering for shifts as you're manning the front desk, as you're in the old laundry services. Those things you could volunteer, but for ordinances, that couldn't happen. I'll admit, to me, this seems like a relic of the 1950s, akin with the caution against allowing men who have been divorced to be bishop. How does one being divorced or one being single prohibit them if they are otherwise worthy from officiating the ordinances? Brian, it's something I've never been able to understand.
Brant, to me, this seems like one of those policies that seem good on paper, but you know, we needed to seriously review it in 2017.
You know, I'm going to channel my inner Principal Svedin from Napoleon Dynamite. I don't know how they do things in Utah, Brian, but here in Michigan, we have a little something called pride. You understand? Basically, volunteers, no matter where you are, whether it's Utah or Michigan, can be difficult to find. Why on earth would you limit that pool, especially if they are worthy in every other area? Additionally, if they're a victim of divorce, and when I say victim, I'm talking about someone who is a victim of marital infidelity or a victim of abuse, why should they be punished for that? It seems like it's one of those things, like you said, that sounded good on paper, but now that we're starting to look at it, it's like, why are we actually doing this?
Yeah, and that's just one side of the issue. I can't imagine those who are over 30 and single are doing this by choice. The previous rule seemed to be a 19th century cultural holdover, and it's about time that it was updated.
Amen. We'll be right back with Rachel Hunt Steenblatt.
If you're looking for more current news coverage on Mormonism, why don't you try the Mormon News Report? The Mormon News Report is a weekday email sent hot and fresh to your inbox every day by 9 a.m. covering the top stories in Mormonism with just a tiny bit of snark. Our focus is on actual news from actual newspaper and reporters covering all aspects of Mormonism. If you're interested in signing up, email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com with your name and zip code. We use that for demographic purposes. You could like the Mormon News Report on Facebook. You could find us on Twitter at The Mormon News, or visit theculturalhall.com/mormon-news-report for more information.
So if you like pajamas, I like pajamas. I'll wear pajamas, give up pajamas, for we know we need each other, so we better call the calling of off. Oh, let's call the whole thing off, yeah.
You say laughter and I say laughter. You say after and I say after. Laughter, laughter, after, after. Let's call the whole thing off. You like vanilla and I like vanilla. You sarsaparilla and I sarsaparilla. Vanilla, vanilla, or chocolate, strawberry. Let's call the whole thing off. But oh.
Rachel Hunt Steenblatt researched Heavenly Mother full-time for the BYU Studies article, A Mother There, Survey of Historical Teachings About Mother in Heaven. She co-edited Mormon Feminism, Essential Writings, which is a fabulous, fabulous book, I must say, for Oxford University Press, and writes at the Exponent blog. She is a PhD student in philosophy of religion at Claremont Graduate University and has a BA in philosophy from Brigham Young University and an MS in library and information science from Simmons College. Wow, that's a lot of college, Rachel. She lives just outside of New York City with her husband and tiny children. Today, we're talking with her about her latest book, Mother's Milk, Poems in Search of Heavenly Mother, published by Common Consent Press. Rachel, thank you for coming on the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So we'd like to get right into your new book, but before we do, let's talk for a minute about the Mormon theology of a Heavenly Mother, because I think that's something that your readers need to understand a little bit before they get into the book, because your book relies heavily on that. I'm sure that most of our listeners are familiar with it, kind of. I mean, I know that, and we'll probably get into this a little bit. We talk about it a little bit at church, but maybe not much, and I know that you've done a lot more research into that. Could you give us a 5,000-foot view of the history of Mormon belief in Heavenly Mother?
So I would probably start with the thing that I think most Latter-day Saints are the most familiar with might be Eliza R. Snow's hymn that we sometimes sing at church called Oh My Father, where it has the line about, in the heavens our parents single, know the thought makes reason stare, truth is reason, truth eternal tells me I have a mother there. And so that's one of the most clear expressions we have, that we have this idea that just like we often talk about having a father in heaven who loves us, that we might also have a mother in heaven who cares about us too. So that's often where people think that this idea comes from. We don't actually know for sure who the first one to teach it was. Many people think Joseph Smith, but we don't have primary evidence of this. But we do have other people during the same time teaching it, including W.W. Phelps, who actually wrote a hymn that was for a dedication of a 70s hall 10 months before Eliza's hymn was first published as a poem. And he had a line about mother or the queen of heaven, or that people take to mean Heavenly Mother too. So we just have people in Nauvoo talking about this. We vaguely know about it now, but then we have the family proclamation that says we have heavenly parents. And so today, if you go to conference or you read conference talks, that's what you're much more likely to hear. So we've sort of had it forever, but kind of loosely and not a lot of detail.
So let me ask this then. It sounds like it was talked about a lot in the early church days. I think people might be surprised to know just how much it was talked about. Have we seen a decrease in discussion on it, or are we seeing like a decrease and then we're starting to talk about it more? Where do you think that that trajectory lies?
I think that there's definitely shifts in it, both like the amount that people have talked about it, but also the way. One of the jobs that I had for when I did do the BYU studies research was I actually made sort of a chart that just looked at like different decades and different periods of how many references there were in conference talks. And one of the things we found was in the 80s, there were a lot, or comparatively a lot, that Spencer W. Kimball had like six or more conference talks where he explicitly said things about Heavenly Mother or Mother in Heaven. Things like that women were created in her image and inherited traits from her. But the early Brethren definitely talked about Heavenly Mother in very normal ways. Like just like we might bear a testimony today and say, I know Heavenly Father lives and loves me. They would say that, but just include Heavenly Mother. Or if they were talking about suffering, they would include her. Orson F. Whitney has a great, beautiful quote about just that all of the suffering that we have, if we bear it well and humbly, that it can help make us more like our Father and Mother in Heaven. So whatever they're talking about, they would just include her.
That's really interesting. Did you notice a difference between male speakers referring to Heavenly Mother and female speakers?
So female ones are actually hard to find in the early days, but we do have Eliza's poetry, and then we have some more references. Like I think it's Susie Young Gates. There are some of the early female leaders that definitely do talk about this or talk about conversations that they had with Eliza R. Snow specifically about Heavenly Mother. And another woman who reports, Diantha Huntington Young, where after her mother died, she was comforted by Joseph Smith saying that she would see her mother again as well as her Heavenly Mother. So we do have early female leaders saying it too, but maybe because they're not in the journal discourses, like we just don't have the same types of records. Or at least I, during that time, didn't have them. Things like Woman at the Pulpit, it's probably a lot easier to find them now.
So bringing it up to kind of current times, the church has recently issued a Gospel Topics essay on its website reaffirming that Mormons do still believe in a Heavenly Mother. Let me just read a quote from the essay. It says, "As with many other truths of the gospel, our present knowledge about a mother in heaven is limited. Nevertheless, we have been given sufficient knowledge to appreciate the sacredness of this doctrine and to comprehend the divine pattern established for us as children of heavenly parents." So there's the language that you're talking about in more contemporary time of heavenly parents is kind of how that concluded. But I also found it interesting that it did refer to it as a sacred doctrine. right? So it is elevated in the church to doctrinal level that there is heavenly parents and in specific a heavenly mother. And I think that's an important part of this essay that came out of it. But why don't we talk about her more often?
I think the answer is so simple and to me a little bit sad that I think just so many of us were taught either by local leaders or by our parents that we just weren't supposed to. And usually the language that was invoked was saying she's too sacred to talk about.
Yeah.
And I once stood in a room in Brooklyn where I was asked to teach my Relief Society about Heavenly Mother and the research that I did for BYU. And as part of that, I asked the woman in the room to raise their hands if they'd been taught that, and every single woman raised her hand. So it's just so common. And I think so well-meaning from the part of the people who repeat this, just because they might think like we don't have this great knowledge or we don't have this great answer. And so this is an answer that they pull to that makes some sort of sense to them or that brings some comfort and helps answer this dearth that we have about her. Where for me, it's not very comforting and I don't think it's true.
Yeah, I mean, the
biggest takeaway.
The subtitle of your book is Searching for Heavenly Mother. So, I mean, is she lost?
Yeah, and I feel like she's not lost to me, but there are periods where really deep hunger for her and I didn't know where to find her. And not everyone is as lucky as I am to have this like paid by BYU 4 months of full-time research to either have the time or the access to the resources to learn that, oh, actually there is a lot more about her than I would have known before. And at that time, I remember Googling just Heavenly Mother or Mother in Heaven or different search terms and looking it up on LDS.org, really 6 things that came up and that was it. So I thought, how on earth am I supposed to do this job? And then the professor led me to better resources, but not everyone is led to those better resources where they're able to search for things. And so even like, it's hard to ask good questions if you have this space, if you start at this place of someone saying, oh, you're not supposed to talk about her. So one of the biggest points of the BYU Studies article is to say, like, general authorities haven't published this. They haven't publicly repeated this idea that she's too sacred to talk about. And in fact, they've actually talked quite a bit about her. And so that's almost what we tried to do with that essay so that other projects could follow and so that more research could be done to try to take away some of the fear or the feeling that it's not okay.
So in your case, do you feel that you've been able to find Heavenly Mother through the historical record?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. At least a really good start, as well as other avenues that we have. Like we have a conference talk in quite a few years ago now. It was by Gordon B. Hinckley before he was the prophet of the church when he was still an apostle. And I think it was called to the Woman of God. I'm trying to remember the exact title, but in it he says that those who pray to Heavenly Mother are well-meaning but misguided. And so here we have this affirmation that the doctrine sets well with him, but that we're not to pray to her because we don't have that example in scriptures, especially of Jesus, who he prayed to as the Father. And so it is tricky to be able to try to learn more about her if we don't have a lot either in scriptures that's super explicit or we don't have so many other things. So for myself, I've tried to pray about her, to try to pray, to feel her love, to feel her close, to learn more about her, to be inspired and guided as I try. So as I do read scriptures to see where she might be there or to be able to look at past records, as well as just to look for her in the people this is around me.
So let's talk about your book. First off, these poems are, Rachel, truly a gift. And
thank you.
They are also beautifully illustrated by Ashley May Hoyland, who also recently illustrated 100 Birds Taught Me to Fly. It was great to see her illustrations in there. She just really seems to capture the spirit of Heavenly Mother so well. And what a perfect pairing between you two. It's truly a lovely, lovely book. I get the sense through these poems that your search for Heavenly Mother, we just talked about it being kind of anchored in the historical record, but I get the sense through the poems that it's really rooted in, mirrored in your own experience with motherhood, as well as your relationship with your children and other powerful women. Tell me a little more. Am I kind of going in the right direction with that?
Yeah, you're definitely, you're right there, I think. So I really love the scriptures in the Book of Mormon and perhaps other places that say that God speaks to us in ways that we understand and that God believes in plainness and speaking plainly in our language. And so for me, it just feels like so much that We can learn from where we are or whatever stage of life we're in. And the stage of life that I happen to be in right now is a mother of two very young children. I have a daughter who's almost four and a son who's one. And so I actually wrote my first Heavenly Mother poem the year that I gave birth to my daughter. It was my friend Martin Polito who helped write the BYU Studies article. He and another friend, Caroline Klein, at the Exponent, they co-founded this art and poetry contest to help there be more art and more writings about Heavenly Mother. So I wrote one and I entered it. It was a set of five and I ended up getting honorable mention, which was enough encouragement to keep trying, but also the poems just would come to me and I just would write them down. And then eventually there were hundreds of these tiny poems that I had written down. And so a lot of them were about specific experiences I'd had with my daughter, especially, or specific words that she said to me or specific words that I said to her. But they just felt like there was something more behind them. And one of those examples, well, the very first poem was about a time when I was going to church with my husband in Brooklyn and my daughter on the train. And I had pumped a bottle of breast milk. And so my husband is trying to give it to her. And she's not taking it at all. She's just looking up at me with these like sad, very big brown baby eyes. And she's mad. And she looks confused and wondering why I'm not just giving her milk the way that I normally do. And then I suddenly remembered something I'd read about trying to feed babies that are breastfed with bottles, that if they can smell their mother or sense their mother close, they won't accept it. So I just had this very strong feeling like, oh, maybe we're weaned. Like maybe this, like maybe we had to feel this absence or separation from her so we could accept this other nourishment. So that's the first poem that starts the book, is about this experience. But then there's another where one day I just was taking a shower and my daughter is on the other side crying for me and calling for me. And I just say these soft words to her, like, I'm right here. I'm just on the other side of this curtain. And then I suddenly thought about the veil and just thinking of Heavenly Mother being on the other side of the veil, saying these same words to us that are so soft and saying, I'm right here. I'm just on the other side of the veil. And so the poem with that just says, and suddenly I knew my mother was. So I do look for her and those experiences that I have with them, as well as, like you said, the strong woman and even sometimes the men around me that I feel display traits of her. And partly for me, that's Joseph Smith's King Fall discourse, where he talks about how we can't know ourselves unless we know God. And so I feel like for women, it becomes so important to be able to know God as the mother, to know themselves as women, but also that it could hopefully go the other way, that by knowing ourselves more, we can know her more too. And so I try to look for myself and I try to look for her in others.
Great. And let's talk about the organization of your book real quick here. It's separated into, and for me, was it three or four parts?
Four parts.
Okay. And I know the first part is called The Hunger. The second part is called The Reaching.
Yes.
The third part is Learning.
Yes. And the fourth is Nourishing.
Nourishing. That's right. And so what I'm seeing just in the way that you've organized this is it seems to follow kind of the development of childhood. Was that intentional?
Yeah, it was. The suggestion came from Jacob Baker, who's a writer and theologian and former classmate at Claremont with me, that I had actually read most of the poems before last summer. I just was stuck on organization. So I reached out to friends to ask for advice, and he thought a progression would work really nicely, like an oratorio, where it starts sort of with this pre-creation and creation and then birth and infancy and so on, like through childhood and early womanhood and womanhood. So I love that idea, but I wasn't really sure how to apply it, because in almost all of the poems, there's a mother and some child. So I didn't know if I should place those poems in child or in mother. But the idea of progression really stuck with me. And so I tried to organize it from a place of feeling that hunger and that reaching emptiness for her that I think a lot of people interested or longing for Heavenly Mother feel. Like that's where we start and what resonates with them, I think. So even at one point, we thought about titling the book Motherless Milk instead of Mother's Milk. Mm-hmm. But then I do in the book try to come to a more hopeful place, like where I can reach out for her, but also where that progression happens, like where I have more, I guess, and learning from the people and places around me. And so I do try to end it in a place that's more hopeful, where there's something coming back from her and reaching and longing for me as her daughter, I guess, or just for us as her children. That reaching and longing goes both ways.
So, Rachel, one of the things that stood out to me, and I think it's because you and I are at similar life points. So I've got a 3.5-year-old and a 1-year-old. Yeah. So we're, you know, all that stuff you're talking about, how you're trying to take a shower and your kids screaming and crying on the outside. Yeah. I get to experience that through my wife, who, you know, tells me all those wonderful stories. But it seems like, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems like that was kind of a defining point for you when your children were born, and it helped to further develop that relationship, or maybe not the relationship, but the experience of yearning for a heavenly mother. And it's almost like that put it in context a little bit more. Did you always have this yearning for heavenly mother, or was this something that seemed to take root when you had children?
I've had it for years before that, partly because of the opportunity I had to research her. But the first time I even remember really contemplating this idea of a female God and having this longing for it was when I was a student at BYU before I graduated. And there was a forum talk at BYU, not even a devotional, but it was an Indonesian poet named Lee Young Lee, I believe. And he read his poems and he noted that the opening hymn that we had sung as a group and the opening prayer that had been said used male pronouns for God. And then he told us he wanted to read a poem that he wrote about God that was called Living With Her, that used female pronouns, and he ended up reading it two ways. And I remember sitting there in the Marriott Center by myself hearing him read this poem about God that had female words and just sobbing, sitting by myself. And I was old. I can't remember if I was 20. I think I was 20. I think I was a sophomore. And it just was the first time that it really hit me. So since that time, and so when the opportunity to research more, but definitely the act of giving birth, as well as the act of caring for children daily and really intimately, has definitely added more context and more concreteness to these feelings that I had had, and given me more perspective both as a daughter before a mother and possibly as a mother before a daughter, before a son.
So there's so many great poems in here that we really want to talk about, and each one is packed with so much heart and soul, and I want to make sure that we can really get into it, but we're out of time. So could you chat with us just a little bit longer?
Yes, of course.
Awesome. Rachel Hunt Steenblick's Mother's Milk, Poems in Search of Heavenly Mother, is now available through Amazon, CreateSpace, and Utah area bookstores like Benchmark and Written Vision. You can listen to our complete interview with Rachel by subscribing to the Mormon News Report Extended Sessions through Patreon.com for only $1 a month, and we'll be right back.
Scriptures are complex. Written over several thousand years by numerous authors from varying cultures and languages, many passages contain multiple meanings and possible interpretations. Furthermore, our present cultural situation unavoidably colors our own means of interpretation. What scripture scholars undertake is a study of the cultural situation of the text. Contemporary Studies in Scripture is an exciting new series from Greg Coford Books, featuring authors whose works engage in rigorous textual analyses of the Bible and other LDS scripture. Written by Latter-day Saints for a Latter-day Saint audience, these books utilize the tools of historical criticism, literature, philosophy, and the sciences to celebrate the richness and complexity found in the standard works. This series will provide readers with new and fascinating ways to read, study, and reread these sacred texts.
And now for your moment in history, brought to you by Today in MormonHistory.com. 180 years ago this week, on August 20th, 1837, Willard Richards wrote the following in his journal, quote, "I began to address the company, but was interrupted. On our return, I was pelted with turnips and etc. by the multitude." He later goes on to say, "The Lord forgave them."
Turnips? Tomatoes weren't available?
Listen, you don't even know the extreme deflation in prices that tomatoes have gone through over the last 180 years. I've looked it up on the internet, Brian. They were considered luxury back then.
Well, the good news is that the Lord forgave them.
I don't even want to know how the big guy would feel if they had used tomatoes, because you know what? There are some things you cannot walk back from, and pelting someone with tomatoes, I don't know if there's forgiveness there.
Well, and that's our show. We'd like to thank Rachel Hunt Steenblick for being our guest today.
Just remember, everyone, to check out the Mormon News Report extended sessions on Patreon. Visit patreon.com and search Mormon News Report, or go to patreon.com/ Mormon News Report, and become a subscriber, where you can hear extended interviews with Rachel Hunt Steenblick, with future guest Mitty Harrison, with future guest Max Perry Mueller, and some of our older guests.
Music was performed by Scott Holmes.
And we'd especially like to thank you, our listeners. If you like what we're doing, go ahead and tell your friends about us. And if you really want to help us out, go ahead and give us a review on iTunes. A little review goes a long way in helping people find us.
Take a moment this week when you're listening to this podcast and hop onto iTunes and give us a review. We really appreciate it. And if you want to reach us and let us know how we're doing directly, give us an email at mail@mormonnewsreport.com.
Until next week, we'll talk to you again after a while.